Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
After an explosion in space, now it's the climax of the rescue mission. Can the astronauts be brought home safely?
What could we have missed?
This can't be happening.
You could hear a pin drop.
"13 Minutes to the Moon" from the BBC World Service, the final episode. Available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 8th of June, these are our main stories. India is reopening large parts of its economy in spite of a surge in the number of coronavirus infections. US justice officials have formally asked Britain's Prince Andrew to testify about his friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Workers at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris have begun the task of removing tons of scaffolding that melted in the fire that devastated the building. Also in this podcast, we have a report from eastern Ukraine, where more than 2,000 people have been registered as missing since 2014. And success for one persistent treasure hunter, but will he ever be unmasked?
I think the identity is coming. I think we'll find out some more details as we go along.
India has begun the most significant easing of restrictions since the start of its coronavirus lockdown, despite a surge in the number of infections. The virus has killed more than 7,000 people since it arrived in the world's biggest democracy. India has just passed the grim benchmark of 250,000 confirmed cases, with no sign of an easing in the pandemic's upward curve. So, why is lockdown being eased further? I asked our correspondent in Mumbai, Yogita Limai.
We had been in lockdown for more than 2 months. And given the economic pressures, really, that seems to be the reason behind the government deciding that unlocking will be allowed. Of course, given India's federal structure, different things are being opened up in different parts of the country. So in many states, for example, markets, malls, hotels, religious places, places of worship are being opened up. I'm in Mumbai, a city worst affected by coronavirus in India. Here, for example, today we don't have, markets and malls and places of worship have not been allowed to open, but private offices are being allowed to open up to sort of with 10% of their staff coming to the office. And so for the first time, actually, since the 23rd of March, I'm hearing the sound of car honking from the street below. Traffic on the road, I was looking outside, seems almost like it would be on any other given day. And of course, the questions being asked as to why are they doing this right now when cases are clearly rising, when medical infrastructure is clearly under a lot of pressure. In cities like Mumbai and Delhi, families are really struggling to find hospital beds for loved ones who've gotten sick. But the economic pressures in a country like India often go far beyond that. So I think different state governments in India have realized that coronavirus is here to stay. We're going to have to figure out a way of living with this virus rather than shutting everything down.
But I suppose the big question is, how are they going to ensure the outbreak doesn't just run riot once businesses are up and running and people are out and about?
That's right. I mean, in lots of places, restrictions have been put in place in terms of, offices. They have to have thermal screening at the entrance. It's mandatory to wear face masks in Mumbai, in Delhi, in lots of other places. There are restrictions in restaurants, wherever they're opening up, that you can only sit at every alternate table. But even given that, I mean, just what we're seeing in Mumbai, today is when we're actually sort of seeing the easing of restrictions. Already we have a situation here where people who need critical care cannot get ICU beds because they're simply not available. So one really wonders, and it really sort of terrifies residents here about what lies ahead.
Yogita Limai. A city without a police force in which a community-based safety system looks after law and order. Well, that's what the council in Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed by a white policeman, has voted for. Its president, Lisa Bender, read out a statement to hundreds of demonstrators.
Our commitment is to do what's necessary to keep every single member of our community safe and to tell the truth that the Minneapolis police are not doing that. Our commitment is to end our city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, to end policing as we know it, and to recreate systems of public safety that actually keep us safe.
But how is this going to work? I asked Natalie Brand from CBS, who's in Washington.
Well, that's not exactly yet known. This is seen as a big signal by a majority of the city council members in Minneapolis, who again pledged to dismantle the city's police department and create a new system. But they also noted that they don't exactly know what that looks like yet. Now, local reporting in Minneapolis says some council members have provided some hints of, for instance, sending mental health professionals or social workers to respond to certain emergencies. But at this point, there's no definitive plan. The council members in a statement to local media also acknowledge this, saying, "We recognize we don't have all the answers about what a police-free future looks like, but our community does. We're committed to engaging with every willing community member in the city over the next year to identify what safety looks like for you." Now, Valerie, also important to note how this will move forward if the mayor of Minneapolis is not on board. He said in an interview over the weekend that he supports what he's calling a new transformative model, but does not support eliminating the department entirely.
Do you think lots of other parts of the U.S. will sympathize and want to reform their own police departments?
Yeah. These conversations are happening in cities nationwide, and I can tell you here in Washington, D.C., we are standing in the street now renamed by the city Black Lives Matter Plaza. Now, some protesters over the weekend added the words defund the police to the new city mural because this is something that some members of the community, some of these demonstrators have been calling for, notably the mayors of New York City and Los Angeles, two of the biggest cities in the United States, have already indicated that they would reduce the budget for the police department and shift some of that funding to other social programs. But again, these are conversations that will have to happen in concert with city councils and mayors.
Natalie Brand in Washington. Reports that U.S. prosecutors have formally asked Britain's Prince Andrew to testify about the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have been confirmed to the BBC, but there's been no official word from the U.S. Justice Department or the British government. The prince, who's Queen Elizabeth's second son, stood down from royal duties late last year following a poorly received interview in which he denied having sex with a woman when she was 17 who said she was trafficked by Epstein. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
The BBC has been told that reports in the USA and here that the American authorities have formally requested that Prince Andrew answer questions about Jeffrey Epstein are correct. Under the terms of a mutual legal assistance request, if Prince Andrew does not voluntarily respond, he can be called to a British court to answer questions. The prince's legal team is bitterly unhappy about the leaking of the request. A source described it as an extraordinary breach of confidentiality. A full statement is planned for later today. It will detail the prince's cooperation with US legal authorities and rebut what are described as outright lies from the US prosecutor in New York.
Johnny Diamond. Around 2,000 people have been registered as missing in eastern Ukraine since 2014, when the fighting between government forces and Russian-backed separatists began. Nearly half have still not been found, according to the Red Cross, but their relatives haven't given up on finding them, as the BBC's Abdujalil Abdurasilov reports from eastern Ukraine.
It's tea time in Maria's flat. She grabs cups from a cabinet as she chats to her 10-year-old daughter, Dasha, standing next to a poster of a little praying girl. Their conversation slowly flows from school grades to Dasha's dad. I look more like my dad, Dasha tells her mom proudly. Maria smiles, but her eyes give away her sadness. Her husband, Evgeny Raev, has been missing for 6 years.
It happened on the 19th of June 2014. My husband left for work and never came back. There has been no official information about him. There was a man, and now there is nobody.
This was the time when the conflict in eastern Ukraine was just flaring up. Kyiv sent armed forces as Russia-backed separatists were seizing towns and cities. At that time, the Rais lived near the city of Donetsk, which had become the stronghold of separatist forces.
The conflict had already started before he disappeared. At that time, many offices were still open. There were no instructions from the authorities. He continued to go to work as normal. I thought maybe he was detained while his papers were being checked. Nobody thought at the time that this would last 6 years.
Since the start of the conflict, the Red Cross has registered some 2,000 cases of missing people, both military and civilian, in the conflict zone of eastern Ukraine. Nearly half of them have still not been found.
I've searched everywhere for information. I've been asking questions. Some people wanted to help, but they were afraid.
What were they afraid of?
Чтобы не пришли за ними.
That separatists would come after them.
For years, Maria told her daughter that her father was just at work.
We went to church and the priest asked the age of the child. He said she needed to start confessing her sins. She cried and said, I wouldn't do it because my mom is lying to me. She tells me that my dad is at work, but I know that he is not. So then I had to tell her. She wept. She was in pain.
Maria now lives in territory controlled by Ukraine, but her search for Yevgeny continues.
My daughter still remembers her dad. She tells me about the games he used to play with her and how he carried her around after work. The child often talks about her dad. We live with the hope that he comes back and this will be all over.
Maria ending that report by Abdijalil Abdirasilov. In Paris, an operation has begun to remove 200 tons of scaffolding from the roof of Notre Dame Cathedral. It was already in place when the cathedral was caught in the devastating fire of April last year and got fused to the roof by the heat. Hugh Schofield reports.
There were major repair works already underway on the roof and spire of Notre Dame when the fire broke out. Indeed, they may have been the origin. In the conflagration, the spire memorably collapsed, but the scaffolding that surrounded it stayed in place, partly melting in the heat and fusing with the roof. Dismantling the scaffolding is a necessary precursor to reconstruction, but the operation is delicate. It's vital that no more damage be done to the vaulting beneath. Over the last months, a second layer of scaffolding has been put round the original scaffolding, and from today, workers hanging on ropes will use electric saws to cut through the fused metal, which in its original state consisted of 40,000 separate pieces. The operation is expected to last through the summer.
Hugh Schofield. Still to come in this podcast.
I have been exploring Stockholm, enjoying the restaurants or beauty treatments or visiting the other islands. As a free spirit, that's what you do.
Fleeing lockdown by flocking to Sweden. There's been widespread criticism of new rules which have come into force in the UK today, requiring people arriving in the country to self-isolate for 2 weeks. The main accusation is that the quarantine comes too late and doesn't seem to be part of a coherent COVID strategy. The government insists that the quarantine is backed by scientists supported by the public and will reduce the risk of a second wave. The chief executive of Ryanair, Michael O'Leary, is an outspoken critic of the policy.
The problem with the UK government is they've been late to every party in this. They were late to lockdown. They've been late at almost every hand's turn, and now they're introducing a quarantine, which is clearly a political stunt because it's not a quarantine. It has no medical effect. And even if you do fill in the form on arrival today, all you give is your mobile number. And what it's going to do is untold devastation, not just to the airlines, but to British tourism.
Ryanair's chief executive, Michael O'Leary. Nearly 3 months after all schools were closed in South Africa, some pupils have returned to classes. Our correspondent Nomsa Maseko reports from Johannesburg.
The reopening of schools was delayed by a week after it became clear that promises to disinfect schools, provide clean running water and personal protective equipment had not been fulfilled. Today, long queues formed at school gates as teachers and pupils waited for coronavirus screening before being allowed in. Each student has been provided with 2 cloth masks, which are to be worn at all times. Basic Education Minister Angie Motshekga said that of the more than 23,000 schools, fewer than 600 were deemed not to be ready to receive students, and that plans are in place to make sure the rest are open by the end of the week. The minister also assured trade unions representing teachers that the health and safety of pupils and teachers would not be compromised.
Nomsa Maseko in Johannesburg. The Brazilian government is being accused of trying to mask the extent of the country's COVID-19 death toll after it stopped publishing the running total of deaths. Experts say the true figure is much higher than the official one. The number of deaths in Brazil overtook that of Italy last week, exceeding 36,000. In the next few days, it's expected to pass the UK and become the country with the second highest number of deaths from the virus in the world, after the US. Our South America correspondent, Katie Watson, reports from Sao Paulo.
On Sunday, thousands of people across Brazil came out onto the streets to say that Black Lives Matter here too. But President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of coronavirus is also enraging protesters. A leader, they say, who's threatening the country's democracy. In the past week alone, more than 150,000 people in Brazil have caught COVID-19 and around 7,000 have died. But that's information the government doesn't want people to know. It's wiped those total figures from its website because it says they're manipulated. Behind those numbers, though, are real people. Patients and health workers on the front line, trying to control a virus that's still spreading.
At least 50% of the registry in this registry, the cyber registry.
Carini Boselli is also on the front line as the president of the Civil Registry Association in Sao Paulo. On the desk in front of her is a huge green book with hundreds of death certificates. Last week, she said, half of the deaths registered in it were COVID-19 related, and far more people than usual are dying from respiratory problems too. And it's not even winter yet when the numbers typically rise. Many experts say that's down to underreporting the real coronavirus figures.
I'm feeling like a soldier in a war, and I need to stay here. I need to have a good eyes and smile to make my public service.
Brazil only tests around 5% of what most of Europe does. The country's struggled on many fronts, not least bad planning by the government. Dr. Celso Granato is the clinical director of Fleury Laboratories in Sao Paulo.
In February, March, for example, there is a huge flood of Chinese tests arriving in Brazil. And we tested at our lab 11 different brands of rapid tests. And 9 of the 11 were completely garbage. And the government just didn't do anything. They just bought the kits and distributed that. They think, well, it's better to test with these kits instead of doing nothing.
In one affluent part of Sao Paulo, São Caetano do Sul, the local government's also trying something different. It wants to get a third of its residents tested. It's running several different projects, including drive-through rapid tests.
There's a constant stream of traffic coming through to the car park. They get to the first line of tents where their details are taken. Only people who work or live in the city can have the tests done. Then they drive through to a second row of tents where there's a team of 3 people in each, and they've got their masks, their gowns, their gloves. their visors and hairnets, and they're taking swabs of everybody in the car. And from then on, they drive to the end of the car park and wait 10 minutes for their test results.
Another of their services is door-to-door testing for those with more serious symptoms. Paula Camargo and her team are dressed in gowns, gloves, masks and visors. They're asking patients to take a swab of their nostrils and throat before sending the tests away to a central lab. Paula, though, feels deflated, not helped by a president who's failing to lead this country through a worsening crisis.
Katie Watson reporting. Sweden never introduced a lockdown and has kept pubs, restaurants and shops open throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. The man in charge of the strategy has admitted it was a mistake and contributed to the country having more deaths than its Nordic neighbours. But it seems to have boosted the country's tourism, with growing numbers of European visitors breaking guidelines against non-essential global travel in search of a beer or even a haircut. Mari Savage reports from Stockholm.
Sweden's largest airport, Arlanda, is almost deserted. Nearly all the shops are closed, there's no queue for taxis. Most flights were grounded at the start of the pandemic as demand for travel plummeted. But Scandinavia's largest airline has resumed daily routes from Nordic cities as well as London. More than 37,000 international travellers used the country's major airports in April. And in southern Sweden, Danes have been arriving by car, while more than 10,000 ferry passengers have travelled from Germany since mid-March. In Stockholm city centre, local passenger boats are busy with people heading off for scenic hikes or swims off the capital's rocky islands, although fewer people are allowed on board than usual to promote social distancing. Peter Albo is an able seaman on the services.
There's been a lot of foreign tourists for us. You are amazed to actually meet people that you know are from Germany or Spain or English also.
One in five hotel rooms in Sweden were occupied at the end of May, the highest proportion in the Nordics. The majority of guests are Swedes, but some international travellers have been staying since the start of the crisis.
Hi, my name is Juana Marco. I'm from London. I've come to Stockholm on the 18th of March.
That's the day after the UK advised against all non-essential travel.
I have been exploring Stockholm, enjoying the restaurants or beauty treatments or visiting the other islands. Some say I'm lucky, some say I'm crazy. As a free spirit, that's what you do.
But people living in Sweden are still being advised not to take holidays abroad until at least the middle of July to avoid getting stranded as the pandemic continues. Peter Clark's a British expat who works as a barber in Stockholm.
Recently we've noticed a rise in the number of British tourists coming into the shop for haircuts. I guess it's a bit of a sucker punch really to know that I haven't been able to go back and see friends and family back home, and yet other people are kind of ignoring the rules and coming here. They could be infecting people while they're here, or they could be coming here and taking something home with them.
I put those concerns to Sweden's foreign minister, Ann Linde.
Our national public health agency does not think that closing the border is very important to stop the infection. The most important thing is to keep social distancing. It's also to wash your hand and is not to stay too close when you are on a restaurant.
She says tourists are welcome as long as they follow the same guidelines. And officials are planning to step up advice for travellers as Europe's holiday season begins.
Maddie Savage. Now, after 10 years and several deaths, a massive hunt for $1 million in treasure has apparently finally ended. Forrest Fenn's treasure chest was said to be hidden somewhere in the Rocky Mountains in the US. And with only a riddle as a guide, it seems it has at last been found by an as yet unnamed gold digger. Tom Trubridge is from KSFR Santa Fe Public Radio.
Forrest Fenn is a famed art and antiquities collector here in Santa Fe. And Forrest hid a treasure, a bronze chest with gold and silver and other valuable items worth between $1 and $3 million, depending on who you talk to. And he hid it in the wilderness here and decided to give folks a chance to go find it, with the only clue being a poem that he wrote.
And this has been a mission for many years for many people, not without tragedy along the way.
According to sources, 350,000 people ended up looking for this chest. Five people died looking for this treasure over the years. And finally, the chest has been located a few days ago, and apparently a photo was sent to Forrest Fenn for confirmation that indeed it was found.
And he said he agrees that, you know, he's seen the evidence, but the man himself is not going to reveal his identity. Is that a bit of a disappointment after all these years?
I think the identity is coming. I think we'll find out some more details as we go along.
Tom Trubridge speaking to Claire McDonnell. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
13 minutes to the moon from the BBC World Service. Season 2 returns with a dramatic final episode.
What is this vehicle going to do when it hits the atmosphere?
Telling the story of how Apollo 13 made it back to Earth.
You could hear a pin drop because it was so tense.
13 minutes to the moon.
Doesn't that look beautiful, you guys? You bet.
Download the whole season now by searching for 13 minutes to the moon wherever you get your podcasts.
How about that, baby?